A Marine's Memories of Tehran in 1979, today on The World. I'm Marco Werman. On this day, 40 years ago, Marine Sergeant Ken Krause was guarding the U.S. Embassy in Iran when it was overrun by protesters.
The one thing that sticks with me all the time is that day, 40 years ago, I made the right decision that kept 19 Americans and four other people alive.
That was months before another storming of the embassy in Tehran that led to the Iran hostage crisis. Also on the show today, a young British woman who ran away to join ISIS in Syria talks about her experiences.
Did you ever see executions?
No, but I saw the beheaded head in the bins.
In the bins? He's the heads of captives?
Yeah.
Those stories and more today here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. Good to have you here today. Vice President Mike Pence was in Poland today to talk about the Middle East. The location was symbolic because Pence had some tough talk for America's traditional allies, Britain, France, and Germany. He says they are part of the problem when it comes to Iran.
The time has come for our European partners to withdraw from the Iran nuclear deal and join with us as we bring the economic and diplomatic pressure necessary to give the Iranian people, the region, and the world the peace, security, and freedom they deserve.
Pence stopped short of calling for regime change in Iran, but he didn't hold back. He said the Islamic Republic is the biggest threat to peace and security in the Middle East. Iran did not take part in the conference and called it a desperate circus. France and Germany didn't bother sending their top diplomats to Poland. The British Foreign Secretary left early. But Pence said those three countries were making a mistake, because the Islamic Republic, he said, has brazenly defied the international community from day one.
40 years ago this month, the mullahs seized control of that country. And every year since, they've supported terrorist proxies and militias, Hezbollah and Hamas, exported missiles, fueled conflicts in Syria and Yemen and beyond. The Iranian regime is the leading state sponsor of terrorism in the world. They have bombed American embassies, murdered hundreds of American troops, and even to this day, they hold hostage citizens of the United States and other Western nations.
Vice President Mike Pence speaking about the Middle East at an international conference in Poland. So let's go back to February 14th, 1979. The current government of Iran was born out of the violence and confusion that was playing out 40 years ago. Loyalists from the old regime of the Shah were refusing to go down without a fight. Meantime, Marxist revolutionaries competed with the Islamists for leverage. The staff at the U.S. Embassy watched nervously as the chaos swirled through Tehran. Then one day, this day, 40 years ago, it happened. Iranian revolutionaries scrambled over the wall of the embassy compound. Later that same day, Ambassador William Sullivan described how the embassy was attacked.
We came under very heavy attack from two or three sides of the compound, and a group of very well-equipped armed men came in here, shot up the embassy.
Ken Krause was there on that Valentine's Day 40 years ago, today. He was a sergeant in the Marine Detachment charged with protecting the U.S. Embassy in Tehran. Ken Krause, welcome to the show.
My pleasure, privilege to be here.
So tell us where you were exactly and what you were doing when you heard that the wall at the U.S. Embassy in Tehran was breached.
I had just gotten off of a duty, a 24-hour on-call, and it was February. It was really cold. Snow had come down the night before, and I had just finished there when I was going back to the Marine House when all of a sudden we started hearing shots really close in. And then, of course, within seconds, we just started hearing the Marines that were near the embassy gates saying that they were taking fire from the rooftops.
So you were holed up in the embassy restaurant. Who were you with and what was happening?
I had hooked up with Sergeant Jack Hinojos and another Sergeant Stanley Lochek. It looked like I was a senior one there. So basically took charge of myself and I said, look, there's no way we're going to be able to get across, back to the Chancery building. So I said, look, if we can hold up here and just make sure that these gates are secure, we'll call Post One and we'll let them know that, you know, we have it secure. And he said, we got a problem. And I said, what's that? And he said, this place is full of civilians. I said, what? He said, yeah, they were trapped here and haven't been able to get out.
Since, American civilians.
There was 19, it ended up being 19 American civilians and four FSLEs, Foreign Service Local Employees. So you got about 22, 23 people all together. But as they, we called them insurgents, climbed over the wall. They fired at us. We fired at them. And we dropped a few of them right there at the gate. And then we knew the fight was on. There was just overwhelming. There had to be 40 or 50 of them in it. In the area, and just the sheer volume of fire kept our heads down. The bullets were going through the windows and shooting up the glass and shooting up the building, and the noise was just horrific. You know, I said, it's just a matter of time before they get angle on us and get superior firepower. And with not being able to contact anybody, you know, you're sitting here looking at the faces of these people that are terrified, and they're just looking at you saying, what are we going to do?
You actually found a way to end the fight at the restaurant anyway, right?
I was standing by a window that had been shot out, and I seen this guy walking around giving orders and, you know, looking like some kind of a leader. Anyway, when he walked around the corner, I stuck my shotgun out the window, and I caught him by surprise. And I told him, don't move. And I said, I'm telling you right now. I said, we can't work something out. I said, I'm going to kill you. I'm going to blow your head off right now.
So the civilians were all released unharmed, but you Marines were captured. What happened next?
Well, what happened is right then and there, that's where the beating started, and he grabbed hold of me, and they had caved in the side of my chest, plus a couple of my ribs, and I was laying on the ground, and he actually grabbed that shotgun, and when he looked at me, I'm still laying there on the ground. I could see it coming, and you know, I just said, God, make it quick, make it quick, and I heard a roar, and you know, that was it.
Where were you when you regained consciousness?
I was told I was taken off the embassy compound, and I was taken to an aid station. Not quite really a hospital, kind of like a dock-in-a-box place. And when I opened up my eyes, I had bandages on. I was laying in a bed. All my clothes had been taken off, and I was wearing a little gurney outfit. And shortly thereafter that, the insurgents came back in that night and said that you're going with us. And, they jerked the intravenous out of my arms and blindfolded, handcuffed. And I was kidnapped out of that hospital and drug out into the snow in back of a vehicle and taken away to Avin prison.
What was going through your mind, and what did they tell you had happened at the embassy?
You lose track of time because you don't see, it's dark outside and you get blindfolded. So you don't know whether it's an hour or a minute, you know, you just lose a lot of track of time. And then, they threw you in a room and, you're handcuffed behind you, you know, so you can't really get that blindfold off. And my wounds had been bandaged, and I got hit with a shotgun in the chest and in the stomach. And I remember looking down and saying, yeah, my stomach hurts like hell. My intestines had been hanging out, and basically all I had done is basically put what they call it, like gauze or almost like surgical tape over it. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
But it just barely stopped the bleeding. And so I was lapsing in out of consciousness when they came to grab me the first time, and they finally took the blindfold off. And, I consider myself being a prisoner of war for the most part. And they said, no, this is not a war. You know, you are a political prisoner now. You're going to be treated like a criminal for shooting and killing Iranians. I said, oh, yeah, that's great. I said, well, you know, there's such thing as diplomatic immunity, and going on and on and on. He says, well, don't have to worry about that. He says, there's nobody left at the embassy. He said, we overran it. He says, everyone's been shot except you. I said, that's not possible. And they all just agreed. He said, yeah.
Right. But in fact, there had been no massacre. In fact, the U.S. ambassador and an Iranian official had negotiated the release of all the captives except for you. So were those officials in the prison just messing with you?
I would assume that they were. Yeah, absolutely. Since they didn't know who I was, they want to know exactly who I was. You know, did I work for the CIA? They didn't know who I was.
It's a good point to remind everyone tuning in that this is not the incident that led to the famous hostage taking at the U.S. Embassy, but the first of two other raids on the U.S. Embassy that same year, 1979. I'm speaking with Ken Krause, a U.S. Marine wounded and captured at the embassy on this day in Tehran in 1979. Back to your story, Ken. You're wounded, you're in jail in Evin prison in Tehran, and then after a few days, you're brought before a revolutionary tribunal. What happened there?
It was, I bet you, it didn't last 30 minutes. And supposedly, for the most part, the mullahs that were sitting up there on the, there were three of them that sat on the, you know, the Revolutionary Council, whatever it was, and accused me of different crimes, et cetera, et cetera. And I just got to a point where we were getting railroaded. And I just basically stood up and said, look, you show me the bodies, the people that I shot and killed. You show me the ballistics. You show me the evidence. You show me the forensics. I said, so then you got nothing. I said, so you just want to take me out and shoot me, then go ahead, but don't sit here and torture me. And they were kind of stunned. And basically, they just took me and returned me back to my cell. And you can fast forward to another couple of hours or days. And the guy that I called number two, because he spoke a little bit of English, he just stuck his head in one day and said, Ed, to answer your questions, they found all the evidence they need, and the trial will not resume again. He says, you'll be shot tomorrow. I said, tomorrow? Yeah, you'll be shot. Maybe in the morning. I don't know. I'll tell you.
Wow.
And I remember those words. I remember his accent, man. I can hear that like it's you know, yesterday. And, you know, you're just left there to say, wow, you know, executed at dawn or whatever the hell they're going to do it.
Long story short, you were released. It was Jimmy Carter who personally intervened to secure your release.
Yeah, from what I understand it was, I was being actually taken up to the roof later that day or that night, whenever it was.
For that and execution?
At the last minute, number two came running up the steps and grabbed hold of the guards that were grabbing me. And said something and then barking at them in Farsi. And they were supposed to take me a different way. And it was a misunderstanding. I said another 5 minutes and it wouldn't have made any difference.
So you received the Purple Heart and a number of commendations and remained in the Marine Corps, active and reserve, for 7 more years. You then served in law enforcement until you retired a couple of years ago. How does this day, 40 years ago today, how has it sat on your mind for the past 40 years?
Now, one thing that sticks with me all the time is that, post-traumatic stress or, you know, when these things start to bother me, the thing that's probably stays with me the most important impact is that day, 40 years ago, I made the right decision that kept 19 Americans and 4 other people alive. Had we decided to go a different way and not surrender and shoot it out, sure, we could have killed a lot more of them, but we'd eventually lost, got overrun, slaughtered, and then he would have taken it out on those Americans, those poor people. And I still see some of their faces today. I remember, you know, how horrifying and shock and puppy dog eyeballs they got. You know, you see them in your dreams at night. And the unique thing is that I got cards, Christmas cards, birthday cards, Hanukkah cards, all kinds of cards and thank yous from people that I hadn't really even met. Just the people in the Caravanserai restaurant from where they got out and went back to the United States all over. And they would always send me, either gifts or notifications, even birth announcements. Thank you so much. God bless. And if it wasn't for you, we wouldn't have this family. So, you know, come away from it all, was it worth it? I said, yeah. You know, it's my life for freedom and for other Americans. And that's what you sign up for. So it's one good thing of all the bad things and all the memories that come by. And that's something I can take to my grave with me.
Marine Sergeant Ken Krause was wounded and captured during the attack on the U.S. Embassy in Tehran 40 years ago today. Ken, thank you very much for sharing your story, and thank you very much for your service. And,
my pleasure, Marco. Thank you very much. Semper Fi. Hurrah!
You're with the world. I'm Marco Werman. You're with the world. On Capitol Hill yesterday, protesters interrupted a hearing of the House Foreign Affairs Committee. The protesters were with the anti-war group Code Pink. They wore bright pink T-shirts with the phrase across the front, "Hands off Venezuela." The man answering lawmakers' questions was Elliot Abrams. Abrams is the U.S. Special Representative for Venezuela. And if you followed American involvement in Latin America over the years, you probably know that Abrams has a history there, a controversial one. Now he's one of the Trump administration officials calling for the ouster of Venezuelan President Nicolas Maduro. Francisco Toro, the founder of the Caracas Chronicles, is worried that those protesters are giving Maduro a free pass.
If we are concerned about human rights in Venezuela right now, we need to be looking at the people committing mass-scale human rights abuses in Venezuela right now.
And what are you seeing? What have you been reporting on?
So we see a pattern of people, especially in poorer areas, who protest against the regime being ratted out by their neighbors who are in the pay of the regime and having special police forces storm into their houses, pick them off, and shoot them, often in their living rooms in front of their parents. This has happened in the last week. In Caracas Chronicles, we interviewed the mother of one of the victims, one of the very few ones brave enough to go on the record on this. Most people are too scared to talk. This is not a notional possible future human rights abuse. This is happening right now.
We've heard that much of Maduro's support still comes from poor neighborhoods. But you said there are large pockets of dissent in those neighborhoods because people are getting rounded up.
They're not pockets of dissent. The vast majority of Venezuelans now want a change in government. They would have had it if there had been fair elections last year. The reason that Venezuelans are protesting is precisely so they can have the kind of government that's able to hold fair elections. This is not a polarized country. There's a large majority of Venezuelans who want a return to democracy and who want an end to the human rights abuses. They need American support. Almost every large democratic country in the world now understands the desperate need for a return to democracy in Venezuela, and that's what Americans should be lined up behind now.
So as the Maduro regime gets more and more painted into a corner, Venezuela as a petrostate, I mean, is the Maduro administration simply going to find new buyers for its oil, new sources of cash like China or India?
Venezuela's oil is extra heavy and has a high sulfur content, and you can't just put that kind of oil through any refinery. By and large, a refinery is designed to handle Venezuelan oil on the U.S. Gulf Coast. It would take investments in refineries elsewhere to adapt them. That takes time. That costs money. And so it's not that the Venezuelan regime has easy options to sell its oil elsewhere. But we should be thankful that this longstanding flow of funds from U.S. gasoline buyers into the torture chambers and the death squads of the Maduro regime has now stopped. That's great news.
Opposition leader Juan Guaido is backed by a lot of countries. He says the humanitarian aid that has been stuck on the other side of the bridge over in Colombia from Venezuela, it will enter Venezuela on February 23rd. What do you think is going to happen on the 23rd?
Well, hopefully the Venezuelan government will realize that it can't afford to keep aid on the border indefinitely, that Venezuelans are suffering right now, that Venezuelans' access to food and medicine is desperately needed in the short term, and that aid needs to make its way across the border. It's not clear to us that that will happen, but if the Venezuelan government stops aid from reaching the people who need it, we hope that the people in the military who are propping the government up and whose own families often don't have enough to eat and enough medicine for when they're sick, that they'll have a word with it.
What do you see as Cuba's role currently in Venezuela, and are Venezuela's generals comfortable with the role Cuba's playing?
Well, the top generals who have made a lot of money through illegal gold sales, through corruption in food imports, I'm sure they're very happy to have the Cubans around. But mid-ranking Venezuelan military officers are under intensive espionage cover from Cuban military counterintelligence. Late last month, Human Rights Watch documented repeated cases of torture where Cuban-backed Venezuelan counterintelligence was rounding up Venezuelan dissident generals and their family members and torturing them to get confessions out of them. It's important to understand that the chain of command inside the Venezuelan military remains functional because there is this level of terror because there are Cuban spies listening to every conversation.
We have spoken with Venezuelans who have not rejected the idea of a U.S. military intervention or some kind of military intervention. Do you feel that some Venezuelans may be naive about what a military intervention would actually entail?
Definitely. There are sections of Venezuelan opinion that have this fantasy scenario where American GIs come and solve all their problems magically within a couple of days. Venezuela is not that kind of country because the state has failed and the country is full of irregular armed groups, people with guns, prison gangs, militias, pro-government militias, anti-government militias. You have all kinds of people with guns. And if there is an invasion and the military either collapses or turns on one another, there are too many armed groups and there are too many neighbors and countries outside Venezuela that have an interest in Venezuela, not just places like the U.S. and Brazil and Colombia, but also Russia, Cuba, China. It's easy to see Venezuela, if there is a war, tending to become a kind of Syria and the Caribbean. I don't think it's a high probability of that happening, but if that did happen, it would be a terrible catastrophe for the Venezuelan people, which is why it's so important that diplomatic pressure get applied, that sanctions are followed together with humanitarian aid. But please, 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 it must not come to shooting.
Francisco Toro founded and edits the online journal Caracas Chronicles. Really good to speak with you. Thank you for your time.
Thank you.
Yesterday, we told you about the arrest of Maria Ressa in the Philippines. She's the editor of the independent online news site Rappler, which has been openly critical of President Rodrigo Duterte. He's called Rappler a fake news outlet. Ressa was arrested yesterday on charges of cyber libel. Today, she was released on bail. And here's what she said about those charges.
This is political harassment. It is meant to intimidate both me and Rappler into silence. But beyond that, it goes to the heart of the role of press freedom in a society. I mean, in the end, press freedom is not just for the journalists. Press freedom is the pillar of a democracy, of all Filipinos' rights to the truth, so that they can hold the powerful to account. That's what we're demanding now. In my case, it's very personal. I was arrested under circumstances that were, at best, to me, seems malicious, that they did it by making sure that the court, the only court that was open that could have accepted my bail, chose not to do it, and they gave the arrest warrant after all other courts were closed.
Ressa says it's moments like this when it's so critical for journalists to do their jobs, and she hopes that journalists all over the Philippines will refuse to be silent.
Instances like this, with such clear abuse and overreach of power, this only serves to galvanize the community, and not just of journalists, but also of Filipinos who are aware that slowly but surely this is our democracy's death by a thousand cuts.
Ressa says too many leaders around the world are undermining the free press, accusing journalists of fake news in order to avoid accountability. A spokesman for President Duterte maintains the government has nothing to do with the libel charges against Ressa. You're with the world. I'm Marco Werman. A teenager worries that her parents might soon be sent back to El Salvador, leaving her to find a job and take care of her sisters.
So that would mean I had to drop out of school before I even start college. We'd have to sell the house we have right now.
What ending temporary protected status means for families. That's still ahead here on The World. I'm Marco Werman, and you're with The World. We're a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH here in Boston. Three teenage girls, classmates, lied to their parents and snuck away from their homes in the UK. They went to the airport and took a flight to Turkey. They wanted to cross into Syria and join up with ISIS, and that's what they did. It was 4 years ago. Suddenly, Shamima Begum, now age 19, has turned up at a refugee camp in Syria. She wants to go back home to Britain. And she gave an interview to the Times of London about being an ISIS bride.
It was like a normal life, the life that they show on the propaganda videos. You know, it's a normal life. Every now and then there are bombs and stuff.
Did you ever see executions?
No, but I saw a beheaded head in the bins.
In the bins?
Yeah.
What was that like when you first saw that? These are the heads of captives?
Yeah. Didn't faze me at all.
Did not faze me at all, she says. Dominic Casciani is the BBC's home affairs correspondent. I asked him if this is the first time we've heard from one of those three teens since they left the UK in 2015.
There was a little bit of communication initially back to their families, and some videos were released, but then everything went very, very quiet. One of the three young women, Amira Abassi, she last had certain contact with her family about 2 years ago. I've been speaking to her father today. One of the three women, Khadija Sultana, she was reported dead in an airstrike on Raqqa at the height of the fighting against the IS group. So this is actually quite a striking story, proving that Miss Begum is alive and is asking, rather incredibly, to come home.
So the Times interviewed Shamima Begum at this refugee camp in Syria. Did she tell the newspaper why she left the camp and why she wants to come back to the UK now?
In essence, what she said, Marco, was the fighting became too much for her. It turned out in the years since she's been away that she's had two children, both of whom have died, one from malnutrition, another from medical complications because of the lack of access to adequate drugs inside the self-styled Islamic State. And the third child was on the way with a Dutch-born husband, a jihadi fighter who spoke English. She's now 9 months pregnant.
I have to think about my baby as well. After my two kids died, now I'm really overprotective of this baby. I'm scared that this baby is going to get sick in this camp. That's why I really want to get back to Britain, because I know it will be taken care of, like health-wise at least.
Now, they've been squeezed, it appears, along with other IS families into a smaller and smaller area as the group is finally collapsing, militarily speaking. And it appears that she took the decision to effectively give up and get on one of the buses out of this small IS enclave and reach one of the northern refugee camps. It appears to be the case that she did indeed leave to save her unborn child. And that raises, you know, all sorts of issues for the UK about what to do.
Will Shamima Begum be allowed to come back to the UK?
In the short term, no. I think it's going to be very difficult. Just assuming she gets over the practical issue of getting out of the refugee camp, because the UK is not going to send a team in to try and get her out because of the dangers involved. If she got into Turkey, she wouldn't then just be allowed to get on a plane and fly home. Her passport may be non-existent. She may have destroyed it, as many of the IS recruits were required to do. If the UK chooses to redocument her, to use the jargon, they'd probably do that with conditions. So they'd probably say, look, we're not going to give you this document to allow you to come back until you comply with some kind of investigation or monitoring. So in practical terms, it's very, very difficult to see what happens next. And I think this is probably one of the reasons why she's done this interview, because I think she's running out of options.
And the fact that she was a minor when she left, and she also said she doesn't regret leaving and joining ISIS, I mean, how does that play into her legal fortunes in the future?
So there are two things there. The fact that she was a minor when she went would have been an issue a couple of years ago had the UK government still had any opportunity to get hold of her, because the law here says that the government has to take the best interests of a child up to the age of 18 into account in any of its decision making. So there would have been potentially some pressure to try and get her out. Now, the fact that she's an adult means that falls away. I think this issue about exactly what she believes is a little bit more complicated than it first appears. When you listen to the full interview that she's done with The Times' as Anthony Lloyd, her views are slightly more nuanced.
On the one hand, you said you didn't regret coming to be part of the caliphate.
No, I don't regret it.
But on the other hand...
When I came and I saw that there was underground oppression and all this happening, it came as a shock to me, like, this is actually happening.
She seems to suggest that she is in some respects relieved that the Islamic State group have lost, but she seems to have no regrets.
Right.
I mean, I've spoken to people in these kind of situations before and their families, and you sometimes hear this. You hear this kind of bold as brass statement that they have no regrets. But actually, once de-radicalization experts start drilling into what they really believe, it starts to crumble. And I think that's going to be the key for this case, that if she were to be brought home, the first thing that would certainly happen is one of the government's approved de-radicalization experts would sit down with her and try to get inside her head and try and understand what she really believes and get a full and frank account of what she did out there. And that will give clues about what they may decide to do with her next. But almost certainly she would face some kind of criminal investigation. And we know from previous cases, there was a so-called jihadi bride who got out of Syria back to the UK, and she was investigated. She was given an opportunity to prove that she was no longer a risk to anybody. And when she started lying to the authorities about exactly what had gone on in Syria, and it was quite easy for them to unpick her lies, she faced prosecution and she was ultimately jailed.
Yeah. Dominic Casciani with our partners at the BBC. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
There's this app in Saudi Arabia. It was launched by the Saudi government a few years ago. It allows men to track the women in their lives, literally. Both Apple and Google offer the app through their stores, and they're getting a lot of flack for it. The World's Lydia Emanalidou is here. Lydia, describe this app. What is it exactly?
So, Marco, in Saudi Arabia, there are these guardianship laws, and all Saudi women, regardless of how old they are, have a guardian. So it could be a brother, a husband, a son, and they have to get permission from them to do things like travel and get medical procedures, kind of like minors here in the U.S. And so guardians can use this app to approve some of the stuff I just told you about and to track women to see where they are. This app is called Absher, which roughly translates to yes, sir.
Wow, that's ominous.
Yeah. And I spoke with one woman. Her name is Raneen Bahari. She's 32 years old and she lives in Saudi Arabia.
If today my guardian decides I don't want her to travel anymore, he can just turn it off and with a swipe. And when I get to the border, they'll turn me back. It is definitely a form of control, but it's a symptom and it's not the problem.
The problem, Raneen told me, is not the app itself, but the guardianship laws, which existed long before this app.
And Google and Apple are caught up in this because they offer this app in their app stores and are therefore kind of perpetuating the problem, as Raneen put it to you anyway. Is that the argument?
Yeah, that's the argument. And probably the most high-profile call for them to remove the app came from Senator Ron Wyden. He's a Democrat from Oregon, and he sent a letter to both companies earlier this week asking them to pull it from their stores. Now, it's important, Marco, to note that this app is not only used for tracking women. Raneen told me that it's also like a government portal where you can do other things like renew your passport. And actually, women can even use it in some cases. Like, Raneen has a car and she uses it to renew her license.
So there's a lot of other things that we use the app for. I haven't used it for much else because I'm a great driver and I don't get traffic violations, but that's also what they're used for as well.
And what does Raneen make of the calls to have Apple and Google remove this from their app stores?
Actually, her answer surprised me.
Coming from a place of privilege where I have wonderful, loving guardians, for me, it's so easy to just swipe my travel permission, you know? I do it myself from my husband's phone. So for me, it's just like, no, I need this. But this is a way of control, definitely. But it also is, for women, an easier way to get access to travel.
So as you just heard Raneen say, Marco, this app actually makes it easier for her to travel because she has access to her husband's phone. And let's say she wants to travel outside of the country, she can just approve that straight from his phone. Whereas before, her husband would have had to wait in a long line, get the approval on paper. Of course, Raneen, as she said herself, is in a position of privilege. Not all women in Saudi Arabia have access to their husband's phones and can do this themselves. But she said, despite that, getting rid of the app won't actually get rid of the underlying problem here, which is the guardianship laws.
Right. It all comes back to the guardianship laws.
Right. And I just want to say one more thing. And this is from a source in Saudi Arabia who wanted to remain anonymous. She told me that the app actually makes it much easier for women who want to escape Saudi Arabia to do that. Like that woman, Rahaf Mohammed Al-Qanoon, who escaped a few weeks ago.
Right. Ended up in Canada after some ordeal in Thailand.
Yeah. And my source told me that if women want to steal their husband's phones and approve their own travel so they can leave the country, they can do that. There is a website version of this portal, but she told me it's much, much harder to kind of hack into it. It's much more password protected and there are more controls around it. The other option, of course, is to do it in person. Kind of hard to imagine somebody, you know, pretending they're a man and waiting in line and doing that successfully. So this is kind of the bright side here. This woman told me that women can get access to it from their husband's phones, approve their travel, and escape if they're in a bad situation.
Well, bright side or dark side, what have Apple and Google said about all this?
So we reached out to both companies, but we didn't hear back from them. They have said in the past that they're looking into this app and they want to make sure it doesn't violate any of their policies. Now, the bigger question here is the ethical question. Should a U.S. company be helping facilitate what some people see as draconian laws in a foreign country? We've talked about this issue with Google in China,
right?
You know, when Google was creating a censored version of its search engine for China. And that is the big question, and it is much harder to answer.
We're going to leave it there. The World's Lydia Emanuelidou. Thank you.
Thanks, Marco.
I need to mention here that PRI has received funding from Google as part of a news partnership. Moving right along, on Saturday, voters in Nigeria will go to the polls to elect their president and a new assembly. Nigeria has been dealing with a bunch of different challenges since its first democratic transfer of power 4 years ago. One of them is the low number of women in political office. The BBC's Myeni Jones has our story, and it starts with an infamous statement made a couple of years ago by the incumbent president of Nigeria, Muhammadu Buhari.
I don't know which party my wife belongs to, but she belongs to my kitchen and my living room and the other room.
It was a statement that shocked the world. In 2016, standing next to Chancellor Angela Merkel, one of the most powerful women in the world, President Buhari responded to his wife's criticism of his leadership with a statement many viewed as sexist. But he's not alone in believing that women's contribution to society is limited to the domestic sphere. It's a sentiment that's echoed throughout Nigeria's political class. Women occupy only 5% of the seats in the National Assembly. Globally, Nigeria ranks 180th out of 193 countries for number of women in parliament. That's the lowest rate in Africa. And traditional African attitudes can't be blamed this time round. The country with the highest number of women in parliament is Rwanda. South Africa ranks 9th, while closer to home, Senegal is 7th.
There are barriers that prevent women from getting seats in the parliament.
Nkuru Ozodi is a senior program officer at the Policy and Legal Advocacy Center in Abuja.
We have a patriarchal culture that subordinates women and upholds men. That kind of promotes certain perceptions towards women in politics, holding men as being more competent than women.
And these perceptions especially impact women trying to enter the political arena for the first time. Indeed, Kato tried to run for a seat in the Kaduna State House of Assembly, but couldn't make it past the primaries.
You have a lot of people talking to you in a condescending manner. You have, would I call it sexual harassment? When I'm trying to be serious and somebody playing, come let me touch you, come let me hug you, perhaps they think it's a joke. Not funny at all.
And there are other structural issues that impede women's progress. In Kuru Ozodi again.
The candidate selection process is not transparent, is not fair. And then you also have, money issues. For instance, a lot of women do not have the financial muscle to contest elections and to run their campaigns.
Why is it that they struggle to get the amount of funding that their male counterparts get?
For instance, in Nigeria, the men are more economically empowered. So, the female candidates are not seen to be bankable. So a lot of people rather put their money support a male candidate than support a female candidate for elections.
There was excitement when prominent activist Obi Ezekwesili announced she was running for president. But her campaign lost steam and she dropped out. I spoke to her when she was still in the running.
We have seen female leaders that emerge, solving problems at local level, solving problems in private sector, in business, solving problems generally in society. And usually those same women can deploy the skills that they used in solving problems at family level to solving problems of nation. But then there is a whole segment of society that still finds it an anathema that a woman is daring to think she can be president of Nigeria.
Gender quotas are behind Rwanda and Senegal's high number of female parliamentarians. But implementing that will require political will, and there's no evidence of that yet.
The BBC's Mayeni Jones reporting there ahead of the presidential election this weekend in Nigeria. I'm Marco Werman, and you're listening to The World. The TPS People's Summit was held this week in Washington. Thousands of people with temporary protected status and their supporters took part. They're originally from all over the world and live all across this country. They came to Washington to ask Congress for permanent residency and to march. It was a family affair in many ways, and the activists were not just adults. There are also children of TPS holders who had an event of their own, and the world's Tanya Karas was there.
On Monday, there was a group of about 15 children whose parents are from El Salvador. The children are American. They were born in the Boston area. And they put together a play for a couple members of Congress and their aides. And the play, it depicts their real lives, real life things that have happened to them. And so it depicts their fears. It depicts them decorating a Christmas tree and worried that this is going to be the last Christmas that they're going to be able to spend with their parents. The whole play was kind of about that and the major decisions that families are having to make at this moment.
Well, let's hear a little part of this play you saw.
My name is Brian. I'm 13 years old and I love soccer. I used to avoid hair on my dad, set up these soccer with my friends. But now I make sure to spend every single moment with him now. His memory won't be temporary to me, but to you it may be.
So Brian was speaking pretty quickly there, but he said he used to avoid hanging out with his dad, you know, just teenage angst and stuff. But now he spends every moment with his dad because he's afraid he's going to forget him when he's gone. That is pretty intense stuff. What else did you learn about Brian?
It is pretty intense. Brian, he is a typical 13-year-old. He grew up here. He grew up in the Boston area. He loves soccer. I was with them over a period of a few days, and it's true what he says. He does really spend every single moment with his dad. And like a lot of kids this week, their parents pulled them out of school and brought them here to Washington. They came from all over the United States to advocate for the parents to be able to get permanent residency.
There was also in this play a 17-year-old named Jacqueline, who's the oldest of four kids.
Why is my government doing this to me? Why are you letting them do this to me?
Before the play, Tanya, you spoke with Jacqueline. I'd like us to hear what she told you.
If my parents were to leave, I'd like try to fight and see if financially I can stay with my sister. But that would mean I'm supposed to start college and the fall, so that would mean I had to drop out of school before I even start college and just get like a full-time job, try to keep up with everything. We'd have to sell the house we have right now.
So Jacqueline's demand from the stage we heard a moment ago, why are you letting them do this? That makes me want to know who was in the audience and what their reaction was to her question.
So in the audience, there were a bunch of congressional aides. There was also Massachusetts Representative Jim McGovern and a lot of aides of Representative Ayanna Pressley and several other mostly Democratic congressional aides. They were all in the audience. Even though there weren't too many members of Congress in the audience that day, word did trickle out that this was happening, that the kids were in town and that lots of TPS holders were in town. And so the kids were actually invited back the next day to talk with several different members of Congress and share their stories. Mm. So in that sense, I do think that their play was successful in its goal, which is to get the people in power to hear their voices.
And what about for the kids themselves, the kids in the play? I mean, they're processing some pretty heavy experiences. How did being in the play help them? Do you have any sense?
I think that it provided an outlet for them to feel like they were doing something. Even if it was small, it was a really big deal for them. And actually, at the end of the play, the lights came back on, the room got really quiet, and all of the kids started crying because they had been practicing this play for months and months. And I think that as soon as they finished, and they just sort of realized that their message had been heard. You know, they had people who have in the room who have the ear of people in power, and they did feel that they'd accomplished something.
So now the actors, the marchers, the activists are heading home. What is next for TPS activists and their movement?
This was the first major national event that they've held. And so now they're all going to go back home and try to continue their activism, try to continue getting legislation passed. The fight really isn't over until they can get something permanent passed.
Tanya Karas, an immigration editor here at The World, thanks very much for telling us about the TPS summit.
Thank you, Marco.
We've got photos of the play's performers over at theworld.org. Finally, on this Valentine's Day, a little unsolicited dating advice from our friends at the BBC's Fifth Floor podcast. It's produced by journalists from all over the world who work on the fifth floor of the BBC's London office, like Kinjal Pandya, who works with the BBC's Indian language services.
So in India, if you're going out with a man, you should see how relaxed the person is. Is he being very judgmental about you? Indian women are looking for independence. They want the man to understand what their dreams and aspirations are and support them and just let them be the way they are. So really look for a man who will let you be the way you are and not change you.
My name is Beryl Wambani and I work with the BBC Swahili TV.
I think for someone who wants to date a Kenyan man or a Kenyan woman, what the best way to go about it is to be humorous. Kenyans really love humor and, you know, being quirky would really go a long way in getting you that date.
My name is Sushira Amakwai. I work for the Thai service. In general, Thai people can be quite shy. So when it comes to dating, you don't even say that you are approaching the person. You might ask your friend to ask for phone number. But these days, people are on social media. So usually they will ask for them, you know, WhatsApp numbers. And then that's how they started.
My name is Prudent Sengiyumva. I work with BBC Great Lakes and I'm from Rwanda. Now, one of the cheesy chatter lines in Rwanda is, yenda twaje gufata kafana, can we go have a Fanta? Even if you know they drink, you never mention alcohol or coffee, you just say Fanta. That sends a signal that you are interested in them.
I'm Olga Ivshina from BBC Russian Service. I think one of the most cheesy lines in Russian would be, oh, ну нельзя быть такой красивой, something like, oh, you can't be so beautiful, that beautiful.
Very cheesy.
Valentine's Day tips from our friends with the BBC's Fifth Floor podcast. Or you can just sincerely say to someone you love, I love you. From the Nan and Bill Harris studios at WGBH, I'm Marco Werman. Back with you all tomorrow.